So today I'm talking about women in Buddhism, and we're going to start out with the Prajnaparamita. We say the Heart Sutra at every practice, and the Heart Sutra is a celebration of Prajnaparamita, which is considered the mother of all Buddhas. So it is a aspect of awareness. When we look at what did the Buddha say when he became enlightened, the closest we have to his actual words are, I have found this new nectar-like Dharma that is profound, peaceful, luminous, free of projections, and uncompounded. So it is the awareness and the veils falling away that cover that awareness that is considered the mother of the Buddha. It's that awareness. So that no one can become a Buddha without directly perceiving that awareness. That's why we think of her as the mother of Buddhas. And I was looking how different traditions tried to conceptualize in terms of words what that awareness is so that we have a fuller understanding. And so interesting to me, in Buddhism, male and female are always together. If you look at any male aspect, you always find a female somewhere. It may be hidden, but you find the feminine. Because wisdom and compassion, or wisdom and skillful means, are always together. So wisdom is the feminine aspect and skillful means is the male aspect. And they have to be together for the enlightened being, because the enlightened being, due to the compassion that opened the awareness, then is benefiting limitless and countless sentient beings beyond a dualistic activity. The nature is to benefit. So when we look in the Chinese tradition, the character for Prajnaparamita is the same as the character for the sky. And so that's one way we're able to start connecting with that complete openness. But also when we look at the etymology of the words, it has to do with fullness and potential and womb-like quality. So there, the idea of from potential, there's manifestation. We can connect to it biologically to think of womb. And another quote from a Zen tradition is, it's not non-being, but wondrous beingness. So that quality of wondrous beingness. There's the emptiness that is not nothing, but it's wondrous beingness. And another beautiful attempt to verbalize it is serenely vibrant nowness. So we have wondrous beingness and serenely vibrant nowness. To think of that awareness that is the mother of all Buddhas. So when we look at the origin of this Buddha, I remember in my early days, some of the first access we have is to the tradition that's been recorded historically. And, a natural question for a young woman to ask is, why is Buddha male? Why are we always saying he? And I asked one of the great lamas this question. And he said, well, Buddha doesn't have to be a he. What's significant is in each culture where a Buddha arises, they have to let go of the most privilege. So in our historic era now, if Shakyamuni Buddha had been a princess instead of a prince, one could have said, well, if the princess had been a king, then she would have been able to benefit everybody, and there would have been another way of achieving benefiting the suffering of all beings. There'd be some doubt, that the ultimate wasn't given up. It was only close to the ultimate in that culture, in that society. So if it were a culture where women had the power and privilege, then it would naturally be a woman who was at the very top of the culture and society, who let go of everything to show that peace and happiness can't be achieved in our samsaric materialistic world. But interestingly, Thich Nhat Hanh is a great historian, and he went back to a lot of the early writings. And the early writings of the earliest stories document that in their previous lives, Yasodhara, his wife, and Buddha Shakyamuni were both bodhisattvas. They could see that he was ready and had the potential to manifest full awareness in this life, and she made the bodhisattva commitment to help him. So she came in as an equal partner to create the circumstance for someone to become enlightened in this particular life. And when I look at the story of the Buddha, I really see it as a family story. And this is important because I remember traveling in Thailand and seeing lots of paintings of the life of Buddha. And in some of the ways it's traditionally told, it has the ignorance of the culture mixed in. So you see Buddha leaving home as though he was leaving his wife and family. And you see the evil temptress trying to distract him from enlightenment. And that's sort of a confused picture. So it actually starts with his birth. When we think of the depiction of Buddha giving birth, it's said that he came out of the mother's ribs. And when you think about that, the significance is he didn't cause his mother pain. And when we look at women in that era, we on our planet now still have a huge problem with maternal deaths during labor. And I remember when my sister, the midwife, went to Tibet, 1 in 9 women died in childbirth. So it's not only that, there can be great complications in the body. In many countries still, it's a life-threatening moment in a woman's life. And certainly we all know and have seen the movies where women are screaming for 48 hours because it's so painful. Again, my sister, the midwife. 48 hours, that's hard. So he did not cause pain to his mother when he was born. That's the significance of that picture. And then his mother did die after childbirth. But later in his life, he went to Shida Heaven, where she was, and taught her so that she and all the beings in Shida Heaven at that time gained enlightenment. So then there was the aunt that raised the Buddha, and Yasodhara's wife. And if you think about Yasodhara, in that culture, in that society, the appearance was that, at first, that the Buddha left. And when we look at it from the perspective of the great love that he had not only for his own family, his own newborn son, I think any father in the world would say, if there were a medicine that could guarantee that this precious newborn that I love could be free of suffering, and I am going to go out and get that medicine, any father would say it was, one has to do it. But not only that medicine was for his dear family, but it was for all sentient beings. And so it was out of love and compassion for all sentient beings and the love for his family, the great love, being extended equally to every child that caused him to go to achieve enlightenment so that all the suffering was relieved and everybody had the path and the doorway to look at how to remove their own suffering. So interestingly, at that time in India, it was one of the comparatively better times for women. So this is when we think of Buddha living in somewhere between 800 and 400 BC, somewhere in there. So there were women scholars at the time. Certainly his aunt, Mahaprajapati, became queen after her husband died and ruled the country. And while Buddha was away searching for the means to become enlightened, there were many different wars. And he came back when there was a war going on. And his peace and the presence of his awareness was so profound that both sides laid down their arms. Now, when both sides laid down their arms and decided to follow him, then, of course, all the women who were the camp followers, the wives, the widows, probably some of the cooks, then were sort of abandoned. So they went to the queen and said, we want to study with the Buddha too. And so the queen said, I do too. We can all see that this is an incredible opportunity in this very moment. And the most recent scholars think now that they were given ordination, but they weren't given the freedom to travel from town to town outside of family protective relationships. It was considered very dangerous. So it was quite an extraordinary journey when they walked 500 miles barefoot to say, we want to study with you every minute that it's possible to study with you. And then he received the women into the Sangha community with very interestingly sort of separate but equal governing systems. So they weren't dependent on the male monastic Sangha. They were side by side, they received teachings, but they governed their community. So they made decisions about their lives. And what is absolutely incredible, I mean really, really incredible, is when you look at how compartmentalized class would have been in that era. Buddha said, any fuel needs the fire, and that was a way of saying there are no class or gender barriers. The opportunity for enlightenment, the opportunity to look at one's mind, was open to everyone. So you would have the queen, the prostitutes, all the working women. Everyone was absolutely together, side by side. And and still today, your seniority has to do with the minute you ordained. So when I was ordained, they recorded not only the day, the hour, but the minute. So if you were in a large sangha, if the lowest class woman was 1 minute before you, she would be your senior. So it was quite an extraordinary social experiment at the same time. And when we look to see historically now, thousands and thousands of years later, we look to see what did make it through history. And they look to see, are there stone monuments where we see the names of people donating, the names of people starting monasteries? Can we find some sort of recorded history? And in the Buddha Sutra, there's actually something called the Theragatha, which are the songs of the women elders. So little snippets still survive from a whole variety of the early women. And then it's also significant to say that essentially Mahaprajapati, the aunt and queen, became the first abbess of the women's community, and that when she died, the miraculous display, the only greater miraculous display, is when the Buddha died. So when we think of all of the, we know just from the Heart Sutra about Shariputra was there, we know some of the names of the different male Sangha, but she actually had the wisdom and awareness that the planet responded when she died. And today I want to tell the story of Patna, one of the women, Patakara. So when we look at these early stories, they're just absolutely heartbreaking. You can imagine, if you had just gone through a war and lost everything, the incredible grief you would have. And this is an incredible story of a woman who was a mother, and in that time, because giving birth was so dangerous, you tried to go to your mother's home when you were about ready to give birth. And so she was trying to get to her mother's home with the birth of her second child, and her husband was traveling with her. And so they were in the woods, and he went to get wood for a fire, but he was bitten by a snake and died. So there she was, and she gave birth alone, you know, calling out for her husband, but no response, and trying to keep her newborn and her son warm. Found him dead, and then still tried to get to the mother's house. And when she's trying to get to the mother's house, she came to this giant river, and she was trying to get across the river, but she couldn't carry both children at the same time. She was too weak. So she carried the newborn and put the newborn in some soft leaves on one side of the river. And then she started swimming back to get the other child. And when she was in the middle of the river, a hawk carried off the newborn, and she started screaming and screaming. And the other child thought she was calling him to come in and went in the river and drowned. So then she's just totally distraught and goes to the village, and she says, where's my mother, where's my father? And they said, ask me about anybody, but not about that family. And that night, the house had caught on fire and collapsed on the rest of her family. So then she went insane, and she just covered herself with ashes and was naked and was just wandering, completely insane with grief. And she headed towards the Buddha, and you can imagine people tried to keep her away because it wasn't a pretty picture. She was, you know, wild with grief. But he saw her and talked to her. And she immediately calmed down and clothed herself and started studying Buddhism, and eventually became enlightened and became the disciple in the women's community that was known as the greatest teacher. So what I selected was, it's a little bit of a poem between herself and one of her disciples, and it was many years later when a disciple came to her who was grieving the death of a child. And so she said, "You cry out, my son. You don't know his coming and going. You grieve. But who knows where he came from? Everything alive is like this. You wouldn't grieve about his coming and going if you understood. He came unasked. He left. And there is nothing you could do. He must have come from somewhere, and he lived just a few days. He came by one road. He is leaving by another. He has gone from the human world, and his journey will go on. He came, he went. What is there to cry about?" And the disciple responded, "She pulled out the arrow hidden in my heart, that grief for my son. I was helpless with grief. She has thrust it away. Today it is gone. I am free and want for nothing. I take refuge in the Buddha sage, the Dharma, and the Sangha." So as we create more and more translators and talented translators, we'll have these fragments, these beautiful fragments from the early women in the Sangha who would... the closest we can see is the wonderful foundational tradition of the Theravadins with meditating every day like the shamatha meditation, and doing, you know, slight amounts of work and then meditating more. And you see the pictures of the people begging for food and being received in their villages. So that was the life that has remained relatively unchanged since the time of the Buddha. So, of course, there was a huge sangha, a huge male sangha, a huge female sangha. Then what happened? Buddhism is barely present in India today. It was Alexander the Great. So Alexander the Great swarmed in. The status of women got lower. As the status of women got lower, the sangha declined. Then the Mongols came in. Huge migration of Islam that was not so beneficial for Buddhism. The tale of every country and migrating peoples going back and forth. And so as Buddhism was declining in India, it was gaining a foothold in China. So it just sort of traveled towards China through Korea, Japan, and then back again to Tibet. Tibet was very, very remote. Unfortunately, in China, it was the Confucian was the largest philosophy at the time. And women were not high status in Confucian philosophy. The adage from the Confucian philosophy is, it's not the hen that crows in the morning. So that seems to be saying something about who's more important than whom. Now when we get to the struggle for women, it's almost the same in every country. The great depths to which women struggled in order to understand that awareness that was their potential. So, you know, we have stories of women being just beaten and beaten and beaten and being told, no, you can't, and things like that. At the same time, we have, again, fragments of history. Like, we know that Bodhidharma had a foremost disciple. He had three foremost disciples. One of them was the... let me see if I can find her name. Zongxi. And so the evidence we have of her comes from the 500s. The first nun was in the 4th century, so it would have been in the 300s. And she was ordained with a group of 24. And we know very little. We know that the nuns' lineage never died out completely, and as the fortunes of women waxed and waned in China, the nuns' community did die out, but courageous women from Sri Lanka, formerly Ceylon, traveled to China to reintroduce the women's ordination. And then, I think that was in something like the 10th century. And then, in 1996, women from the Chinese lineage went to Ceylon to reintroduce it in Sri Lanka. So you have incredible women in every era, doing their best to make sure the heritage of the women's ordination succeeds in every country. So, in China, one of the reasons they think that women's communities lasted longer and were able to hold the lineage is the women's communities were more independent from the men, which means they had to become more self-sufficient. As Chinese Buddhism developed, the predominant form of Buddhism became Chan. And so you would have monasteries, Chan or Zen, but the monasteries were passed in the same way family homes were passed. They were passed as property. And legally, under the Confucian legal system, women were not allowed to own property and were not allowed to appear in public. That would be a problem. Can you imagine if you were trying to get teachings, but you weren't allowed to appear in public? Historically, there were always women who transcended the obstacles of their time. But this is one of the reasons we don't have the recorded history and some of the writings. We know that when Dogen from Japan went to China in the 13th century to explore Buddhism, that there were many strong women teachers because he was recommending not only that people study with these remarkable teachers, that they pay them the same respect that they would pay to the male teachers. So he has left a record of instructing his students. And he said, you should become their disciple. It is looking for drinking water when you are thirsty. And it's only natural to offer respect. So those are some of the keys we have. And then we have Tibet. And one of the reasons I'm giving this talk today is because when I open the altar and there are new people here, I say something about Guru Padmasambhava, who's on the altar, and the Vajra Guru chant that we do, because Guru Padmasambhava removed many of the obstacles for the firm footing of Buddhism in Tibet. But he did not bring Buddhism to Tibet. And so we say, well, King Sangsten Gampo brought Buddhism to Tibet. He did not bring Buddhism to Tibet. He married into Buddhism. There were two queens. The Nepalese queen, his first wife, Belza Thristen, and she brought the Mikyo Dorje statue. And the Chinese queen, Gyatso Kanjo, who brought the Jowo Shakyamuni. So here we have in Boston the Jowo statue that's becoming such a great pilgrimage thanks to Gyatso Kanjo, the great queen. The same thing happened in Japan. There was a princess, and there was many, many philosophers coming. The king of that time said to the princess, it would be good if there were some Buddhism practice here. You should become a nun with a couple of your friends. And so she did become maybe a pre-novice, and then decided that she needed more education. So she went to Korea, and that's where she was for many years studying and more. I don't know if she was fully ordained or not. But she came back to Japan. Previous king died. New king didn't like Buddhism. So they went to her monastery, and they pulled out these three nuns, and they beat them to pieces, and they, you know, tortured them. And unfortunately, a plague hit the city at the same time, and only the nuns were healthy. So they interpreted that as... there was a problem with that kind of behavior. So then they allowed them to go back to their monastery and practice again. And the monastery that she built survives to this day. So we look to see, when we look at a more complete history, everywhere, you know, we think of Dogen establishing firmly Buddhism in Japan, but it's thanks to the early work of the Japanese princess that initiated things. Tibet was extremely remote. And so when ordination came to Tibet, it only came in terms of the novice ordination, because the novice vows are the same in the male and female community. So I received my novice ordination from His Holiness Chetsun Rinpoche. I could receive it from any of the lamas, because the vows are the same. The female vows are not the same for Bhikshuni ordination. So there have to be 10 women who've been ordained 12 years in order to conduct the full ordination for women. And that's why it never reached Tibet. There were never a group of 10 in that very remote place that could offer ordination. However, Tibet Buddhism is of the Vajrayana tradition. So we talk about the 84 Mahasiddhis. When we look at who the Mahasiddhis were in the Vajrayana, who were the great masters, our recorded history has something like 6 or 7 of the Mahasiddhis were women. And they also have incredible stories. It's like the Catholic lives of the saints. Everybody's tortured and set on fire and then miraculously displays the incapacity, that they couldn't be killed by the fire, etc. But the story for today, it's sort of a funny story, because the women often appear in Buddhism to bring a little attention to arrogance when it's needed. So there was this great yogi, and I like the story because he had a cute little dog. And he rescued this dog, and then he was in his cave, and he went into meditation. He goes deep into meditation. He's in the Dakini realms. Everything is wonderful. He's learning. But he can see that his dog misses him. Maybe he misses the dog a little bit. So he keeps trying to leave, and finally he goes. And when he comes down to find his dog, still at the cave, having not eaten the whole time when he was in the mystic realms, you know, his compassion opens and he feeds the dog. then the dog turns into a dakini. So it was his compassion for the suffering beings that brought him back. And it was the dakini manifesting as the dog to awaken that last burst of opening of his heart. And I was trying to find one other story because it was a little bit more to do with arrogance. It's very, very similar. It's a yogi deep in meditation, and then he ends his meditation, and he sees that his dinner got cold. And so he says to his wife, you know, my rice is cold. Go get me fresh, hot rice. And she goes, if you're worried about that, you're never going to get enlightened. And then she that cracks open his last ignorance, and she manifests as the dakini. So I encourage you to look at some of the stories of the 84 Mahasiddhis to look at because they were some of the great, great masters. We, in our prayers at the end, we give the Kagyu lineage prayers that are Tilopa and Naropa. Tilopa and Naropa are two of the 84 Mahasiddhis, but they're women in there. What I also find very interesting is that the enlightened women that appear illuminate the path for women in a different way than Buddha illuminated the path for men, because women's lives can be very different. And so when we think of Yeshe Soigel, and Yeshe Soigel was essentially sold into marriage. She didn't want to get married. She wanted to practice. She wanted to find her awareness, her great awareness, but because she was beautiful and it was political, women in that area were married for political reasons. And people were fighting over her because she was so beautiful. And she tried to run away and was beaten and brought back, and tried to run away and beaten and brought back. And so you can see the universal story of women in so many aspects of her life. And the other significant part was that she was raped. And so when she was raped, she after the rape taught the men, and they became karmically connected to her, and over time would have found wisdom. But there was a sense of, in the story, of how to work with that women's experience in another way, how to see it in another way. Then she, like Buddha, did many years of retreat, many vows with her Rinpoche, and then she recorded all of Guru Padmasambhava's teachings. And we only have a few fragments of her teachings, but due to her kindness and her diligence, we have so many of Guru Padmasambhava's teachings. So there have been these magnificent stories over time. Another thing that I find tremendously interesting is some of the stories we have about women in relationship to the 84 Mahasiddhis evoke the great fear of some aspects of women. So Luipa, the fish eater, was told to go learn from the town prostitute. So the fear we have of the sexually free woman as being dangerous, you know, in many cultures. She became the enlightened teacher that he had to study with in order to understand his greatest wisdom. And then for those of us who've gone to a new stage of the aging process, there was Naropa and the old lady. Not only the old lady, but the ugly old lady. So a woman who is considered not attached in old age, so would have old age without a son or grandson to protect her, was no longer attractive, would be an outcast in many cultures. And that woman becomes the one who breaks the ignorance for someone. And a lot of there are a lot of Japanese Zen stories like that too. The tea seller woman who, you know, smacks the arrogant students around to open their ignorance. So it's tremendously interesting to look at how women appear, how they are in the stories, what's their significance, how they destroy different aspects of our ignorance. So then I wanted to talk a little bit about Buddhist women today and Buddhist women in the U.S. In the U.S., we think Buddhism first came with the Chinese railway workers on the West Coast in the 1800s, I guess. And we certainly know that they brought Buddhism with them, and there was a connection so that teachers came over, particularly with the Japanese Zen priests. But there's another way that Buddhism was open to Westerners, and that came through scholars. So there are a number of, in the early 1900s, women scholars who learned Sanskrit, who became tremendously devoted to establishing Buddhist philosophy and spent their whole lives then going back to the source and bringing Buddhism back, founding, there was the Women's Buddhist Bureau was founded in 1935 by a woman named Miriam Salaneth. And then Ruth Fuller was a Sanskrit scholar. She was born in 1893 and eventually married one of the great Zen teachers and established a monastery, and they translated many, many, many of the texts, and their translations are considered definitive. Then there was I.B. Horner, who was born in 1897, who served in the Pali Text Society for a great portion of her life. And so we have the translation of the Vinaya from her, for men and women, into English as something that's used and studied. So we have that wave of women, and then we have another wave of women that we can call incredible pioneering women in meditation rather than in scholarship so much. And I think of G.U. Kinnett in that, and we think of the great English nun Jetsun Tenzin Palmo. G.U. Kinnett way predated Tenzin Palmo. She was born in 1924 and went to a Japanese Zen monastery, studied under great, great hardship there. When you look at these women, they certainly were scholars in the sense that they became fluent in the language of the country that they went to. But they went to She went to the monastery in Japan. The master wanted her there, but no one else wanted her there. And so what happens then is you're given, like, a closet, if you're lucky, to sleep in. And you're barely tolerated in the meditation hall. So she talks about her struggles and overcoming those struggles, and then after the death of her master, she was not welcome anymore. So she came to the U.S. and started Shasta Abbey and a group of monasteries in the Zen tradition. And you know, so interesting to see how, with some of these great pioneers, even years and years later, they're not included in the honoring and the history and the celebration, and that's often how women's names have been lost throughout history. And so in our tradition, in the Tibetan tradition, just so you have a sense of the stamina of these people, one of the first women to get through the Tibetan school, the dialectic school in Dharamsala, which is, you know, the Harvard of monastic studies. Karma Lekche Somo became fluent in Tibetan, and she was given the room next to the outhouse. So not only was the smell overpowering, but the roof wasn't good, so it was flooding all the time. And she stuck that out. Now we're celebrating the first woman to get the Geshe degree. I think that may have happened last year or the year before. But it was because of Karma Lekshe Somo's work 20 years earlier, forcing the door open, that later women were given conducive conditions to study and were able to make it through that school. And not only that, the first group of women, we know that this brilliant German woman got the first degree, but the group of people, of Tibetan nuns who were studying there, who also got their degrees, were from a small nunnery that Karma Lekshe Somo then started after she completed her studies and funded so that Tibetan nuns would have the opportunity that she had to fully study at the same level as the monks. So, I mean, it's the work that some of these women have done, the hardships, is just awe-inspiring for me. When we look around the world, in Taiwan, because the women's lineage was always strong and was just for a very brief time broken, they evolved into incredible abbesses running huge monasteries. There are probably more nuns than monks in Taiwan, and they have gigantic monasteries, and they're more similar to the Catholics in terms of they're doing huge environmental projects, huge relief projects, huge... There's a nun named Zheng Yan who founded the CG Buddhist Compassion Relief Association, which is staffed by nuns and does, continuous work. So they're exemplary. They're great teachers and are tremendously benefiting society in many different kinds of ways. And then I wanted to say something about the contemporary nuns in America and contemporary teachers that we have, also in terms of the directly benefiting beings. Thich Nhat Hanh's co-leader, Sister Chiang Kong, who came into being a nun with an incredible commitment to social worker, and is... what I find most moving about some of her writings is how he taught her to continually do social work in some of the most difficult situations without anger, and how to calm her anger. And some of her writings about trying to bring relief during the Vietnam War, with bullets flying overhead and both sides of the army angry at anybody trying to do relief. She did stunning work with the boat people as well. In Thailand, Thailand is a very interesting country in that they made becoming a nun illegal. I really like that. That's hysterical. Great Buddhist country. Many monasteries, but being a nun is, I believe, still illegal. What the nuns did in that country is there was a state senator, or a high-level government official, and she left the country and became a nun in the Mahayana tradition, and in Thailand is the foundational tradition. So she came back, because she was so famous and had such high status, they didn't do anything. And she was very quiet and very humble and made her house the monastery. So she didn't make, She made a huge wave, but she didn't make any more waves. Then her daughter became an incredible scholar. She was a university professor for a long, long time. And she took ordination in the tradition of her country. She went to, I think, Sri Lanka and came back. But she was extremely well-known, very, very careful in paying great respect to the monastic tradition, and working with she was working with really the poor in a in very, very good ways. She was beyond criticism, let's just say that. So that allowed the cracking of the door. Then there was, I mean, here we are. This is a 2014. So I forget what year it was, but it was, you know, 2010, 2011. There are a fair number of Western monks, and they're saying, well, this is, you know, really outdated. We have to be able to ordain women. And an Australian monk in the Thai tradition decided to ordain candidates in his monastery. So he was excommunicated like that. In England, there was a very strong monastery in that tradition outside the country, where women were living with vows, but not with novice vows and not with fully ordained nuns' vows. And the Western monks said to the women, our tradition doesn't allow this, and unless you sign this paper that says you will never request ordination ever, that you will not teach if there's a man there who can teach, a list of incredible things, you have to leave. And some of the women had been there a long, long time. So probably about half the women left. It was a very, very difficult for everybody. But you can see, how do you change a whole country's view? It's not an easy thing. So some of those women came here, and there was quite a wonderful nun here, the Venerable Karuna Dhamma. And she held the first full ordination for women ordinations. She came from the Vietnamese tradition in this country. I think the first one may have been 1997, something like that. And I think it was around 1912 or so, held an ordination for some of the women who came from the Thai tradition. So they have decided to start a lineage independent of their country's tradition. It's thriving. So you see slowly something changing. In the Tibetan system, it probably will come in the near future. But the Tibetans are in a unique situation in that they're refugees. And so if you look at what is the greatest concern to refugees, it's how do we hold on to the most wonderful things from our country without them losing their power, without them losing their significance, without them losing the integrity. So in the minds of the conservatives, they're not seeing a way for things to change. When Buddhism dispersed, there became different schools of the Vinaya. So although things are the same, there are just tiny, tiny differences, and you're ordained in your school of the Vinaya. So the Tibetans have to open to another school offering the ordination to the women in the Tibetan tradition. Now, on this continent, His Holiness gave me the ticket. He said, and, you know, please, you know, in order to bring Buddhism to this continent, you know, there has to be the ability to conduct the ceremonies. in order to have the ability to conduct the ceremonies, you have to be fully ordained for many ceremonies, and particularly monastic ceremonies. And so His Holiness, the head of our lineage, in the case of Pema Chodron, who was the first nun to be ordained, in the first U.S. nun in the Tibetan tradition, at the express wish of the previous Karmapa. So we can see that the heads of the lineage have the vision, and they understand the importance and significance that monastic communities run by consensus. So they are not, they will only say over and over again, it's wonderful, it should be done, I support it, and they wait for everyone to come to that view. And we hope it will come in the near future. And it's just very interesting to see, for me, how fast the Tibetans are changing. You know, when we think of how long ago did women in our country get the vote, and how filled with anger some periods of our struggle have been for equality, and then to see the Tibetans condensing the time and having much less animosity is heartwarming for me to see. So when I look at the early women who took ordination in this country, Pema Chodron, each one has defined what is their responsibility. What can they do with their lives to firmly establish Buddhism in this country? So you see Pema Chodron establishing a monastery, establishing a three-year retreat center, building a giant stupa, and assisting one of the great schools in getting started, the Nyitartha Institute, started at Gampo Abbey. Then you see Karmalekshe Somo. Not only did she finish her studies before the degree was allowed to be given to women, she started the first nuns community that had the expectation that they would receive a full education, and she took women from all the remote places in the Himalayas and accepted them on the condition that they would go back to those remote areas afterwards. And then she founded the Sakyadita Society, and what she did with that, it was really interesting. She went to every country and held a world conference on women in Buddhism and spotlighted the women working in that country. And so she illuminated, this is what the Korean nuns are doing and how wonderful they are, and then the whole world saw it. And this is what the Sri Lankans are doing and the whole world saw it. So she lifted people through this organization. Jetsun Palmo, as we know, has started an incredible monastery in India. And there was a lineage of meditation that is, we have the Togdens who spend their whole life in retreat. But there were also Togdemmas. There was a women lineage of that. And so she's bringing that lineage back so that that path of meditation is not lost. And then just as throughout time, extraordinary beings have incarnated as extraordinary teaching masters. So we have someone like our incredible founder, the Venerable Dahani Awahu, growing up in a Native American family, but having a vast awareness and without the vocabulary to identify beings, having her mind linked with Guru Padmasambhava from earliest times. As she came in contact with Buddhism over time, she realized, oh, these aspects of my mind are Vajradhara, are Guru Padmasambhava. Other aspects of my mind are from my family Cherokee lineage. But her mind was open in, her mind was vastly, vastly, vastly open. And then seeing what could she do to maintain her lineage teachings in a culture where it was only in the late 1979 that it was legal to practice the Native American religion. So she had a duty to her Native American lineage to firmly establish what was lost and bring it into future generations. But also, she had vast Tibetan teachings to establish and make sure they weren't lost, her Terma teachings, as well as the foresight to say, in order to establish something on this continent, we have to have a place to study, we have to have a place where people can come and meditate through the course of their lives in a directed, focused way. So when we say Buddhism is established in a country, what's the difference between a country that is established and a place where there's only weak Buddhism? It's where there's the fourfold Sangha. The fourfold Sangha is fully ordained monks, fully ordained nuns, lay people, men and women. So even Tibet didn't have a fully established Buddhist Sangha because they didn't have fully ordained women. And so to create the Sangha on this continent, can you imagine? Your duty is to a continent. say, we need to start a monastery here, we need to start a nunnery here, we need to have access for future generations to all the different ways that open all of the doors of Buddhism. So we're living in extraordinary times that we have access to the fragments of history and these incredible living teachers. And it's a privilege in this life to be able to meet and study with Pema Chodron and Venerable Dahani Awahu, particularly as my root guru, and some of the other wonderful, mighty women who are crossing cultural boundaries with such grace and without any fear of hardship. People are doing extraordinary jobs. We have Thupten Chodron, who's established a monastery on the West Coast and has written probably 10 or 15 books and is particularly dedicated to the Tibetan Buddhism offering full ordination in our Tibetan Buddhist community. So it's quite inspiring to look at some of the women in Buddhism and some of our history, and we have so much access to some of the great male teachers. Every once in a while, it's good to remember that they were always with women's support in some ways. And so if we look at our dear His Holiness Chetsang Rinpoche, he has his sister. And she's very humble, and she would say, oh, you know, don't look at me. But I have great admiration for Namla Takla, who has identified one of her many projects throughout her life to help the Tibetan refugees is to encourage, strengthen, educate the Tibetan nuns to run their own monastery. And if you remember, I was saying that in China, we think that the nuns' lineage lasted the most continuous time. It's because they had the education and leadership to run their own monastery. So by bringing women of all cultures into educated leadership, then hopefully the current access to study and practice will be open for men and women for future generations. So, are there any questions? Oh, for the phone line, it's *6. And the Skype, if you wanted, you could unmute. Okay. I'm glad you're here, but don't leave. I have some. Any questions on the phone? Yeah. Okay, there's a question on the phone. Judy, you have a question?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, I don't have a question, but I just want to say how much I appreciate this. Gosh, this was wonderful. I'm excited about the information. I'm going to tell people about it. I just feel like it was wonderful. I just wanted to say thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. We'll put this on the website for people to have access. And Tiny, were you trying to ask a question? I heard noise from the computer. Okay. Oh, good. I'm glad you were able to stay on for the talk. Any questions? Tiny, if you could mute yours again, there's a funny noise. Thanks. It's interesting, yeah.
But it just struck me like I had a lot of respect for the things I read about her.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized how different
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's until we're able to see without blinders on, it won't be cured, but we're making progress all the time. Judy, did you have another question? Okay. Judy was expressing appreciation when she was on. Okay, so Crystal, do you have a question or a comment? Crystal, did you have a question or comment? Okay, it's star 6 if you would like. Carrie, did you have a... It was illegal. Thailand was not the only country. I don't know exactly. All I know is the Thai government gives a stipend to all the monks and monasteries, and by including women, there certainly would be an economic something. I don't know. we know that that the history of women and the history of women in Buddhism are so interconnected that if the status of women falls, then the ability of women to practice and teach also falls greatly. And so you look at migrations of philosophies that evidently, like for instance, in India, the position of women went up and down. But the idea that women would throw themselves on their husband's funeral pyre is late, and it's a mistranslation of the spiritual thing, the spiritual direction. The spiritual direction was go up to the fire, and it was mistranslated in that era as go into the fire. So you can see how just cultural views and confusion and philosophical ideas. Really, Alexander the Great. The Westerners that came in. So now it's karmically, some of the monks who are more conservative feel as though it's the Western women pushing Buddhism to change, but it's our karmic undoing of the Alexander the Great. Yes. Yeah. It was men and women who were confused and men and women who weren't confused. And so you're absolutely right. Okay, so bodhicitta, excellent and precious mind, where it is unborn, may it arise, where it is born, may it not decline, but ever increase higher and higher. Thanks, everybody. It was fun to try the Skype. Tini, I'm glad you could try it, and it helped us learn how to do a Skype group call. So we'll work that into more of our Dharma talks. So have a great sunny day. Okay.